The views expressed on this program are those of the individual participants and not necessarily those of WVUD or the University of Delaware. Welcome to WVUD's Campus Voices, weekly conversations with interesting members of the university community, visitors to campus, and others engaged in thought-provoking research and community service. Stay tuned for Campus Voices on WVUD.
Good morning. I'm Richard Gordon, and my intern Rachel Silva and I are in the University Library, where we're talking with Arlene Wilson, a doctoral candidate in the English department and a grad assistant, and Rebecca Johnson Melvin, librarian and head of manuscripts and archives. And Arlene, why am I here?
Well, you're here to talk about the Solomon Bailey exhibit that we have downstairs in the library, and I would think it's in part due to Black History Month and the fact that Solomon Bailey was an escaped slave from Delaware who immigrated to Liberia during the colonization period in American history.
Before I heard of your exhibit, I'd never heard of Solomon Bailey. Tell us a little bit about him.
Well, Solomon Bailey was an enslaved person in Delaware. He wrote his slave narrative in 1825, and the name of it is a narrative of some remarkable incidents in the life of Solomon Bailey, formerly a slave in the state of Delaware, North America. Now, he was not able to write his own narrative, but he did have a gentleman whom he met who was interested in his story who wrote it down for him. So what we find is that Solomon Bailey was a slave in Delaware. He essentially purchased his freedom from his enslaver, but he was released, and then his enslaver essentially recaptured and kidnapped him. So the narrative itself is pretty interesting, but the gist of it was is that he had actually paid for his freedom. He's kidnapped and re-enslaved, and then he escapes. So his entire family is actually still held in slavery. He is smuggled down to Virginia and walks 320 miles back to Dover, Delaware, to petition for his freedom again. So he eventually does get his freedom, but he has to pay his enslaver a second time.
So he had to walk back. He was kidnapped and taken to Virginia, and then
yes.
He walked back?
He walks back. Delaware state law at the time prohibited enslavers from removing slaves from the state, and he was actually removed. So once he removed, he petitioned for his freedom, was granted the opportunity to purchase his freedom, which he did. But it was obviously against his enslaver's wishes. You know, he wanted to keep his human property. And so he is kidnapped and smuggled out of the state and taken to Virginia, where presumably, I guess, his enslaver thought that he would sell him and then purchase a new slave. But Solomon Bailey escapes off the back of a wagon. And I mean, when I say he walks from Virginia to Delaware, I make it sound like it's a walk on the beach. It takes him a considerable amount of time to do it. He's dodging slave catchers who are actively pursuing him. They send dogs on him. He's lost in the woods. He's terrified. He prays most of the time. He prays, and I think that he really does experience a type of spiritual conversion during this traumatic hardship. But he does manage to get back to Delaware.
Was he born in the United States, or was he brought over from Africa?
As far as we know, he is actually from Delaware. I believe that he is the descendant of slaves from Delaware. So he was actually born a slave, so he's a Delawarean.
What were the source of the materials? Were they from the university libraries, archives, and manuscript collection?
So other than being, you know, informed by Curtis Small, as a librarian who I work with in special collections upstairs, of these letters, essentially these letters, when I first encountered them, they seem a bit out of place. I mean, other than the fact that this is a Quaker family and they're, you know, an abolitionist family, they seem out of place in a sense that it's a record of white history, if you will. And so to find letters from an ex-slave who's actually able to write, particularly given the time period that this isn't post 1850, you know, late 1840s. This narrative is published in 1825. So to find these letters written in his own hand from a Black American who immigrated to Liberia, I could only presume that it's in following the colonization society's movement during that time to remove free African Americans out of the United States and resettle them in Liberia. So finding these records was literally as though Solomon Bailey is like arising from the dead, if you will, this graveyard of the past. It's pretty extraordinary to have letters in his own hand, in his own handwriting. And they tell the trials and tribulations that he experiences in Liberia, problems eating, finding food, infighting with the natives there who did not want these settlers there at all. Their hand was basically forced by the U.S. Navy to sell their land or else. So they did not do this willingly. The Liberians that, you know, the tribal people who were living there, this was their territory, this was their land. They didn't want, you know, African Americans being resettled there. So to find these letters is pretty remarkable in and of itself.
We're talking with Arlene Wilson and Rebecca Johnson Melvin, both in their roles with the University Library. And Rebecca, what is really so special for students like Arlene to find primary sources that they can use in our manuscript collection?
So I think that's a great question, and this is a perfect example of how a small introductory exhibit can raise some questions for scholars to take further. These primary sources, and these are unexplored letters, really are first level evidence and information that a scholar can mine in greater detail and explore in the context of other sources in the family papers. And so it's really just the beginning of an investigation.
What was your impression? I mean, because you're getting the opportunity to work with, you know, firsthand primary sources.
Well, for the first thing, you know, as a graduate student, I'm thinking, well, no one has published on this. I could be the first one to strike while the iron's hot and get published. So, I mean, obviously thinking it from that standpoint. But, you know, these papers obviously differ from my research outside of the library, but the one thing that it does for me is it brings to bear the importance of primary sources. You know, much of the work that I do is based on secondary sources, you know, sources that scholars have written about primary sources, material that they have gone to the archive to mine, and this was one of my first opportunities to actually pick up from the archive specifically a document that no one else has really written about, and to contextualize or attempt to contextualize these letters in a broader national environment and historical moment that is going on at this time. And I have to admit that there are some pretty interesting questions that are raised, one of those being, you know, in the letters themselves, he speaks of hardships. He is asking for help in a lot of instances. He doesn't have a lot of the basic staples of, you know, that he needs to sustain life, food, adequate food supply.
Is in Liberia?
This is while in Liberia. And he, Curtis Small and I actually had a conversation about this. He read the letters during winter break as, you know, to compile the pieces to put into the exhibit downstairs. And I just asked him, I said, you know, pretty remarkable, right? And he says, yeah. And I said, what struck you as odd about these letters? Other than the fact that, you know, there's no medical care. His wife has a terrible spill. We glean these from the letters. Solomon Bailey is writing to Joseph Bringhurst and says, my wife had a terrible spill. It nearly cost her life. She's not fully recovered. And there's no medical care. He is in desperate need of supplies. But the one thing that I thought, and Curtis also mentioned, you know, a surprise with this, is that multiple letters go to the Bringhurst family, Joseph Bringhurst, and there's no reply. No reply. So he's later, the later letters show a desperate, please respond. I really need these supplies. Are you getting my letters? I sent the money for it. I have a contact who can pay you for it, or who has already given you money for it. So for me, it, you know, looking at these letters, and we say, okay, so the Bringhurst family, abolitionist family, important family in Delaware, it's almost in a sense that they get credit for being on the right side of history, if you will. But when you really get to the ins and outs and you start to nuance it out, you know, what was that relationship? Are we perhaps in some ways giving them more credit than what they actually deserve? And I don't have answers to those questions. So it really, these letters for me, and I hope for others that that decide to investigate a little bit further, that these are questions, research questions, that really should be brought to bear and answered more thoroughly and investigated more thoroughly. So,
as you're talking about that, Arlene, I'm thinking this is one of the values of primary sources. That is, you get to see things firsthand and ask your own questions, and maybe the answers aren't what the conventional wisdom is.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that that's one of the exciting things about being a scholar. It isn't a matter of just following on the coattails or, really in the stream of thought of other people, but really, in a sense, adding your two cents into it and really trying to get at these types of questions. What, to be an abolitionist, did that just mean that you were anti-slavery? You know, you were against slavery, but that you, in a sense, still harbored racial hatred or disgust? Yeah, that's possible. Was this family seeing Solomon Bailey as an equal human being? Or were they seeing this through the eyes of a white abolitionist during the early Republic period, where, their religious responsibility and their religion called them to value human life, but not necessarily hold Solomon Bailey on equal footing with others? How does that change our thinking about what it means to be an abolitionist during that time period? And it also raises questions about what type of resistance and conflict that African Americans and Africans in America during that time period would face. There's one thing doing things because your religion tells you that it's the right thing to do versus doing things on your own impetus and according to your own moral compass. And you're doing it not for religious gain or currency, gaining religious currency if I'm a good person because I do this, but because you inherently feel that something is wrong and you decide to take action because you feel it's the right thing to do. So, and that's the thing, is with these letters and the lack of response, did the letters get lost in the mail? Obviously, the family got the letters because we have them, but that those are areas where further research and investigation would definitely need to be conducted to find answers to those questions. But as a graduate student putting it together, right off at the top of reading these letters, I'm like, huh, why wasn't he responding?
Well, this is great because it does raise the fact that history, the telling of history, does depend an awful lot on who's doing the telling.
Well, I think that the Solomon Bailey letters being included in this collection is important because, and especially as an African-American scholar, is we get the black voice, right? So it's one thing to have a collection of papers where we can see what a white abolitionist family did through the course of several generations even, but you're getting at the issue of race from one side. To actually have the written words and sentiments of an African American who had been previously enslaved and gone through the ordeal that he had gone through, it offers the other side. There are always two sides, and it definitely offers the other side. And one of the challenges of being a scholar of African American literature is the fact that history, in a sense, has been whitewashed. Those stories and narratives have been left out because they tell the truth of racial hatred. They tell the truth of enslavement and the trauma and devastation that it causes. And so when you're writing a narrative of national pride, it's problematic to include that in there. I would argue that it needs to be included, but it becomes problematic because that narrative is, in a sense, not accurate. And so when we get these types of archival work that speak from the African American him or herself, I think that they're vitally important because it is a necessary part of an entire narrative, of a whole story, that only really essentially one side has been thoroughly written.
Well, like they say, whoever wins the conflict gets to tell the story, and I think that certainly is true with both Native Americans and, Africans in America.
I would say, though, that this shouldn't have been a war, and that we are one people. I'm not so sure that, whites won the war, if you will. We can say the North won the war, but it was in the cause of essentially righting a moral wrong. And in a sense, so there's this contradiction. There's always this inherent contradiction within American history writ large, is that we have this narrative of we are a free people. We have liberties that are guaranteed by the Constitution. We believe that all people are created equal, yet we can enslave in the name of freedom.
And yet so many writers of the Declaration of Independence were slaveholders.
Yes, and we also have a lot of African-American signers of the Declaration of Independence as well. They were not all white. And so that is, that is a story that essentially gets left out. So I wouldn't say that, you know, perhaps a way to resituate this is not a matter of winners or losers. There is a sense of, are you what you say you are? And if you are not, you need to correct that. So if we are a nation of free people, and if we are a nation where we inherently believe that all people endowed by their maker have the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, then any type of enslavement of any human being for any purpose is against our moral constitution and our political constitution. So any actions that support that type of enslavement, you're living a lie. And so that is where the whitewashing of history comes from, is because there is an inherent contradiction that many of us today have a hard time reconciling. And I think that adding the Black voice, adding the Native American voice, the Asian voice, the women's voice, the Jewish voice, and all the other bodies to that narrative helps to resituate our narrative so that it is accurate. We cannot live to our potential. We cannot live to the promises of this country without doing that.
I was reading a biography of Tecumseh. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I really admired about this book, I wish I could remember who wrote it, was he would say, we don't know what happened. Here's what this letter says, but there's no evidence to say that is really what happened. I mean, that's an important part of history, too, is like, you know, looking to see what are the gaps, as you've been talking about, Arlene.
Right. In my dissertation research, I look at the only known African-American convict narrative from the 19th century. It was finally published in 2016 by a gentleman, his name is Austin Reed. He was imprisoned as a 10-year-old child in New York, and he's essentially raised through the prison system and has a high recidivism rate. He spends most of his life in prison, and so Caleb Smith from Yale University wrote the introduction to Reed's narrative, and it was found at an estate sale in 2009, and they did all kinds of extensive background archival research to find out who this individual was. I spent most of January going to multiple archives to try to find the missing pieces. And so it speaks to what you're saying, is that, you know, as researchers, and particularly as, you know, a researcher of African American history and literature, there are pieces that we don't know. We have to try to make not educated guesses, but educated conclusions as to what we think likely happened. It can be very frustrating, but it's also extremely rewarding when you find your guy, so to speak, in the narratives. I was there with my husband, and the room was very quiet. We had boxes of information all over the place. And I was like, Rob, I got him. He's here. Austin Reed's here. And I was very excited. So it's a sense of satisfaction when you go to the primary sources. But at the end of the day, we have no idea what happens to this person once he's released from prison. And then he writes a letter back to the refuge house in New York asking for his records. He's, in a sense, trying to pick up the pieces of his life. And then he falls off the radar. We don't know when he died, where he died, if he ever married, did he ever have children, does he have any descendants? We know nothing about him. So one of the things that you have to consider as a researcher are what were the mediums that were available, and as an African-Americanist scholar, what were the mediums in which the Black voice was kept out of, yet how can we still find it in there? Because we found Reed, his name in the punishment logs, for example, but his story, I can corroborate his story that he gives in his narrative by just going to the archives and reading what the prison logs say. I don't have to have Reed's name next to it. When he says that they were waterboarded, I can find evidence of that. When he says that prisoners died because they were beat to death, I can find evidence of that. When he speaks to the cruelties, and when he says that laws are not just, they're not a language of justice, they're a language of power, I can corroborate that in the archives. So you have to think of sometimes thinking in reverse a little bit, but I think that you can essentially find the information that you need. We have to learn how to read what we're seeing, because we may not actually get a Bringhurst family papers in collection, and a collection of generational papers where you can kind of track a family through multiple generations. When you're doing African American studies, it doesn't fall into our hands like that.
Well, Arlene Wilson, a doctoral candidate in the English department and a grad assistant in the library's special collections, has put together this case about Solomon Bailey. And you can hear how quickly, as you're talking, not just about Solomon Bailey, it expands.
Yeah, no, it does. I mean, there's, you know, this is one life and a span of letters that span several years, but they fit into a historical moment. And they speak to this one individual, and his immigration to Liberia speaks to a national historical moment with the colonization movement within the United States. So it's interesting on one level that it speaks to enslavement, and even when an individual was free, they didn't feel free enough to stay. They literally tried to pick up and leave to attain all the things that they, according to our own national beliefs, they should have had here but did not. And it also ties into Delaware history, Delaware's history of slavery, the history of this family, history of religion, as well as, like I said, on a national level, what America, white America, was trying to do at the time to address their problem with race. I don't see race as a black issue. I see it as, they say that the problem of the Negro. I don't see, and especially I don't think that the archives show us that either. I really see this as a white problem with the black race.
The white problem with many different races.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
One of the reasons I wanted to come talk to you is that, to me, the idea of having a Black History Month makes it sound to many Americans like, oh, we need to worry about this for 1 month. But you're tying this together with other cases. This is a time to start the conversation, but it should continue on with scholarship all throughout the year.
Well, I think it goes, absolutely. I mean, I absolutely agree with that. It's very frustrating for me. Being a person of color, it's insulting even that, and it's the shortest month. And, that's something that's always repeated. And it is the truth. It really is the truth. But, I've actually had conversations with friends of mine that are like, oh, well, you get 1 month. And I'm like, yeah, but okay, let's look at this. What would the South be if you removed all black people? Well, you don't have the Southern Belle because she's working in the fields. This whole notion of, in a sense of Southern pride and Southern manners, you can only have that off of the backs and labor of people who, of people who you are enslaving against their will and literally working to death to the point that their life expires. Of course, if you want to think of yourself as a decent people, you don't want to add that into the history books. But what I think many people today are saying is that, no, you do have to add that into the history books, and it isn't something that you slip in for just a short month out of the year, that there is no American history without black history. You remove black people, you don't have a White House because they're the ones that built it. So I think that in order to have the type of healing and reconciling, these ghosts, we talk about American history and American literature being haunted. It's haunted by these voices, and they come up. They come up through the cracks and scream. And so it's a matter of reconciling this and coming to terms with who we really are as a people, and if we don't like it, to change it.
Rebecca Johnson Melvin is also with us, librarian and head of the Manuscripts and Archives Division. And to that point, Arlene's exhibit downstairs has been extended through the end of March, I believe.
Right. It'll be on display in the first floor of the library when you walk in, right past the central information desk. And it is just the tip of iceberg and sources that are available in special collections, not only in this one collection, but other sources, such as you see two printed items that are on display in the case, the published narrative of Solomon Bailey, and then you want to say something about the other piece, Arlene, that's in there?
Right. The other piece that we have in there is from the famous abolitionist William Lloyd Garrison, and his text is called The Thoughts on African Colonization, or An Impartial Exhibition of Doctrines, Principles, and Purposes of the American Colonization Society. They had long titles back then. It was published in 1832, and William Lloyd Garrison would go on to form his own abolitionist movement, or his own society within the abolitionist movement. But he initially had joined the American Colonization Society, also known as ACS, And he was about 25 when he joined. And he initially joined because he thought that this organization was created to promote the freedom and manumission of slaves. But it didn't really take him long to realize that many of the members of the ACS were not advocating for manumission. They were actually just advocating for the expulsion, the removal of free blacks in order to make slavery in America easier. Because you wouldn't have freed family members petitioning the government and also just being a free black body in society, that any black body would be an enslaved black body, so that the direct correlation between black and enslaved would be totalizing. And it would actually make it easier to promote slavery without these individuals being here. Once he realized that, he left the society and formed his own. I think that there's a collective body of people that live here. We all have our histories. We have intersecting histories, histories that build on top of each other, that rely on each other, and that only speaking to one narrative that essentially, like I said, gets whitewashed. Because, you know, I mean, the history of how white women were treated in this United States is it's not stellar either. And it shows a dehumanization, it's demoralizing. And so having a strong archive, teaching students how to work in the archives, the importance of primary sources, and also, I will say, the importance of contextualizing the information that you find on your own without always going to the secondary sources. I think they're absolutely important. They've done the work before us, but that thinking independently on your own, because your history, my history, as people of color in the United States, there is a certain lack of indoctrination to some degree that we know that we're not white. Right. So when we're sitting in classrooms and we're reading about the dead white men like we do in history, we understand that there's another history there, because how did we get here? And we know our family members. You know, I have writers in my family members. I have World War II veterans. I have doctors. I have family members who have been lynched. I have family members who were enslaved, escaped slavery, went to Canada. I mean, this makes people feel really bad. I'm half white and half black, so this is really difficult even for me. I mean, you know, half of my family were enslavers and the other half were enslaved, if we really look at the history. And so on one really human level, we can understand how generations later kind of want to, like, you know, it's kind of like the crazy uncle that nobody wants to talk about. and I, you know, I say this kiddingly, but it's far more serious than that. Mm-hmm. But I think that there, you know, these pieces of information are kept out of the history, and in a sense, depending on what classes you take, are kept out of the literature as well, and you're getting a partial history that promotes this idea of the white race being the dominant race. They are the ones that built all the literature, they wrote all the history, and that everybody else was just, you know, a secondary side player pushed to the margins, and that they weren't really as worthy, able to work, or not as intelligent. And when you keep their literature out, you keep their narratives out, you keep their petitions out, because there are many petitions to the U.S. government by African Americans, you know, petitioning that this is, you know, colonization is wrong. We completely disagree with it, as what William Lloyd Garrison said is, this is immoral. And just because you remove, you know, free blacks from this United States, the moral sickness of this country, it doesn't fix that. It doesn't get at that. And if we don't get at that, that will propagate throughout history, which is, I think, I think we're dealing with that today.
Rebecca, why don't you tell us what website people can go to if they would like more information about Arlene's exhibit and everything else that's going on in Special Collections?
I think the simplest path to take is to the library website, and our exhibits are featured from there. So that's library.udel.edu.
Well, thank you so much for having Arlene Wilson and Rebecca Johnson Melvin, for letting Rachel Silva and me come to talk to you.
And thank you so much for having us and for allowing me to speak about the project. And I just feel really honestly blessed to have been selected for this position, and then to have been exposed to these letters. And there's so many more things that they have in Special Collections that I invite anyone to come down.
Thank you all.
Thanks for listening to Campus Voices. The views expressed on this program are those of the individual participants and do not necessarily reflect the official views of WVUD or the University of Delaware. For more information about Campus Voices and to find archived episodes, visit our website, www.udel.edu/campusvoices. We invite you to tune in every Thursday morning at 8:30 for Campus Voices on 91.3 FM, WVUD, and WVUD HD1, Newark, or online at wvud.org.